Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast to the US Open. You find myself, David and Matt in the media garden at Flushing Meadows. It is 5:44 p.m. This is going to be a two-part podcast. We'll bring you all the news, events and drama. And there has been drama from the first half of the day in this part of the show. And then later on, we will be back to wrap up all things night session and some late day session matches as well as we speak. Félix Auger-Aliassime has just walked past us with his first round opponent, Mackenzie McDonald. They are headed for court number 5 to start their first round match. And court number 5 will feature prominently in this part of the show because it is the court on which fourth seed Holger Rune lost earlier on today. There goes Jennifer Brady. Did she win, Matt?
She was a set up, I know that.
She must have won because I left her in a second set tiebreak to come and do this podcast. And yeah, I think that's her first Grand Slam win since 2021. Big moment for Jennifer Brady. And another theme of this half of the podcast,
yes,
right
there. All these people walking past us right now are really setting up the theme for part one of day one. Before we get on to that, I need to tell you about AO Travel. They are sponsoring us throughout this US Open, and they operate the travel program for the first Grand Slam of the calendar year, the Australian Open in Melbourne in January 2024. Each year, AO Travel brings thousands of tennis fans from across the world to Melbourne Park to witness world-class tennis and soak up one of the world's most livable cities. And we only do it for 3 weeks per year, but we can very much attest to Melbourne being a livable city. AO Travel can take care of your flights, premium accommodation, tournament tickets and behind the scenes experiences, so you just need to pack your bags and get ready for an incredible trip down under. And new in 2024 is the AO Travel Lounge, overlooking Rod Laver Arena and Grand Slam Oval, not to mention the Melbourne City skyline. It's exclusively available to AO Travel guests. You can wine, dine and enjoy the entertainment in this premium air-conditioned event space. Cannot stress air-conditioned enough. That's a deal-breaker for me at the Australian Open. For you and your fellow AO Travel guests to enjoy all day and all night. And if you're a friend of the Tennis Podcast, first and foremost, thank you. And secondly, AO Travel are offering you a discount of $500 Australian off any premium lounge package. So visit ausopentravel.com to book today. That's ausopentravel.com to book today. Now then, shall we start, folks, at court number 5?
Oh, yes.
Who knew that court number five was going to be the epicentre of Flushing Meadows on day number one? Certainly not Holger Rune, who lost out there 6-4, 4-6, 6-3, 6-2 to Roberto Carballos Baena, who was sensational today, we should say. I know he's not the story here, but that's probably the win of his life and thoroughly deserved, David.
Yeah, I mean, performance of his life, certainly that I've ever seen. I've probably seen half a dozen of his matches that I've really taken notice of over the years, and he barely missed a ball. He was going toe-to-toe with Rune. He was getting the better of him from the baseline. When he was asked to come up with a shot, he came up with it. And, I mean, I think it must have meant a lot to him, judging by the celebratory scenes. I mean, either his partner or a member of his family or his wife, I'm not sure who it was in the crowd, was absolutely in tears upon him winning that match. It clearly meant a huge amount, and he was well worth the win.
Yeah, and he deserves an awful lot of credit, and we absolutely give him that credit. He is well worth his position in round number two. But we are now going to proceed to talk about Holger Rune for a little while, because it's a fourth straight loss for him, first and foremost.
Well, he's had six if you include Hopman Cup.
Wow, okay. I mean, it's been an absolutely horrible summer. Since his unexpectedly good grass court season, it's been a unexpectedly horrific hard court season.
Yeah, really bad. And basically, every time I've watched him, he has not looked physically fit, to be quite honest. Certainly that was the theme of his couple of matches on the hard courts coming into this. He had to retire during one of them. Just hasn't looked physically fit. And I find that extremely worrying. I did already, and I now find it even more worrying considering the answer he gave in his press conference.
I thought that was a low-key mic drop moment. There were a few of them in Holger Rune's press conference, but his response to Matt's question today, I found quite shocking.
Me too.
Actually.
What was the question?
I basically said to him, every time I watch you, you seem to be injured. Have you ever considered not playing a tournament because of injury? And he said no.
You were kind of asking, how close have you got to not playing a lot of these tournaments? Have there been decisions that you've made?
Yeah, exactly.
Close to the wire.
Yeah, and he said that.
He said,
He said he has never considered not playing. He says he doesn't get scans or anything. If he feels something, he just feels his own body and trusts that.
He said, oh, some players are getting scans every time they feel something. Like,
yeah, he was kind of judgy about
you're
it.
You're a professional athlete, mate.
I mean, he's got a chance.
You're a millionaire
that.
Professional athlete.
Yeah.
If the scan shows nothing, then great. But why wouldn't you get stuff checked out?
On one level, I think, oh, what a lovely old school way to look at your career, because that's what they used to do. But I also think, what are you doing? You know, yeah. When I consider what Andy Murray was telling us and in a press conference on the eve of this tournament about how many scans he had for a little tear in his app and different angles he wanted, and you know, surely you listen to that. I mean, and you take advantage of science and technology that is out there. I mean, I get that maybe he doesn't know about that stuff yet, but he's got people around him who surely know what's what and know. Tell him. And him, listen, for goodness sake. I mean, I'm afraid that, you know, I heard about a practice session he had here with Andy Murray on the eve of this tournament, and he was, new can of balls, and he was smashing them out of the stadium when he was getting annoyed, you know. He was doing that against Andy Murray in practice. I love his impetuous nature on one level and how he doesn't care. On other levels, I think, actually, you know what? You probably need to be a little bit more respectful in a situation like that, and you need to be a little bit more respectful for the kind of job of being a tennis player and the professions of those around you who are going to advise you on what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think he looks so jaded. I think he looked shot in
press. He was so tired in that match. Like, he had no energy in the match at all.
He looks burnt out.
Yeah, that's it. And all of these injuries that he's having, or matches where injuries are showing up, are always preceded by the most intense workout video on social media that you have ever seen. Maybe not quite Maria Sakkari level, but certainly, like, you know, he is working so hard, but it feels to me like he's working himself into the ground. And if he's playing through injury, he's making things worse. And look, I have some sympathy. As you said, he's a young player. He needs people around him to be telling him this stuff.
Yeah, he's a 20-year-old kid.
Yeah,
and not a mature 20-year-old. Like, that is why you have people around you, and he's good enough and now wealthy enough that, you know, he should have the best people around him.
It's that thing I was talking about the other day where, like, his greatest strength is his appetite for it and his hunger and his desire and how much he loves it. But it's also a weakness if he's only going on that and not paying attention.
Tsitsipas warned us of that.
Right. Yeah. He genuinely did.
Wow.
That was in the Australian Open, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I like him, but he needs to calm down.
Yeah.
When his press conference was announced as being about to begin, a lot of people trooped towards court number one, and everybody was murmuring about the tweet with the map of the grounds, sassily saying, just in case you need some help finding court five, where I've been scheduled tomorrow. And I
love that.
I thought the tweet had got so big, the reaction to the tweet had got so big, I thought he might really row back on it and go a bit corporate about the tweet. I was wrong.
Excellent.
He did not distance himself from that tweet at all. He totally lent into the entitled brat energy of that tweet. I would say he almost doubled down, Matt.
Yeah, I think so. But again, I found that, like, I enjoyed the doubling down and I enjoyed the owning of the tweet, but what it says about him as a person and a player, I don't think is good news.
Oh, hugely alarming. He made an official complaint to the tournament.
About what?
Being on court five.
Sorry, who are you?
Well, he said...
If I was the referee, who are you?
He said when you're ranked higher, you expect better playing conditions and benefits. And he says the ATP give them to everyone, but they're not giving them to me. And I just thought he just sounded so entitled.
Yeah. Yeah, and he did... He said, you know, I'm a world number four. And actually, that clanged a bit. I hadn't quite processed the fact that he's world number four. And okay, world number four on court five. It's a lower court assignment than I would have expected. But then, as we did on the live show yesterday, you go through who else is scheduled in court five, and you think, well, okay, he's not been past a Grand Slam quarterfinal. Very few people here in New York know who Holger Rune is. And I mean, complaining to the tournament, he said at first they responded and explained to him that American players are given prominence because it's an American tournament. I mean, having to explain that to him feels... They must have thought, okay, we're gonna have to spell this out for him. And then he said he responded again and they just didn't reply. They did not reply to the follow-up. So, I think it's doomsville for 2023 for Holger Rune. I struggle to see him getting his year back on track, and he's probably going to qualify for Turin, but I just can't see him being in any shape.
He so needs a rest and just to rebuild. I mean, look, I'm afraid it is another example of the difficulties of the length of the year. But Andy Murray, I remember when he had his run at Wimbledon in 2005, he said he just entered everything over the summer after that, probably 7 or 8 weeks back to back, because he could. Suddenly he's got all these opportunities that he's not had before. And it's living the dream, isn't it? And suddenly Holger Rune is a top 10 player, and he's managed to get a win over Carlos Alcaraz, and he's beaten Novak Djokovic twice, and we all know what he's capable of, and he loves it, and he wants to play all the time, and he thinks he can. well, I'm sorry, you can't. And if you carry on like that, you're going to damage your career irreparably. Now, I don't think he will do that. I think common sense will prevail. He'll eventually figure it out. And look, he's young. I don't want to be too hard on him. And I also love the fact that he just talks in press conferences. Mm. You know, I'm kind of simultaneously criticising him and loving it. But, you know, he's got to learn how to be a professional a bit more.
The stuff we love might damage his career, frankly. I mean,
don't want him to become corporate ruiner.
No. But really, he should have seen the reaction to that tweet and gone, I've misjudged this. Why don't I try and row back a little? And I would have been disappointed, obviously, but it probably would have been for the best for him. Let's stay with the men's side of things while we're there. And let's head to Grandstand Court, which is where Matt and I headed for our first live tennis of the US Open 2023. And a first Grand Slam match main draw win, David, for Dominic Thiem for nearly 3 years.
Amazing.
His first win here at the US Open since he won the title in 2020. 6-3, 6-2, 6-4 over Alexander Bublik. This is a tough one because we're obviously thrilled for Dominic Thiem. We're thrilled for tennis. If you don't want Dominic Thiem to come all the way back, I'm not sure how much of a tennis fan you are. Like, just objectively, it would be a good thing, and it is a good thing that he's won today. And I want to ask, what does it all mean? Is this a sign of that it could be starting to happen? But unfortunately, the absolute disgrace of Alexander Bublik today makes it pretty much impossible to discuss this as a serious tennis match.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly put. If we're looking for the positives for Dominic Thiem, and, you know, of course, getting that win is a big thing. How much can we read into it? Well, he made the point in his press conference that, you know, any win is kind of big for him, and he took confidence from all the wins that he had in Kitzbühel the other week. He takes confidence from finally getting a win at a slam for the first time since January 2021. So undoubtedly there is a positive sort of impact that hopefully this can have on Dominic Thiem as he tries to get back. But in terms of actually trying to grasp how well he's playing and what it might mean for the rest of his tournament, almost impossible, because Bublik would have lost to every single player in the draw.
He might have lost
today
to David Law today. You'd have won points.
We'd have probably been trying to do...
You'd have won points against him today.
Well, didn't
because...
you get four double faults in a row in one game?
It wasn't in a row, but it was four double faults in a game.
Right. I mean...
And double faults all over the place, terrible drop shots, basically tank.
From midway through the second set, it was a tank, pretty much.
He and I would have played quite similarly, I think. I'd also...
Like, you'd have been trying your heart out.
I'd also have had a little stroll towards the service line as my opponent's about to serve.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? That his sort of creep move, the creep towards the service line, and then the quickly backing off just as they hit the ball. And there was a moment, which actually Matt and I watched most of this match from the press seats, but obviously you're not getting the on-court microphones there, so we didn't pick this up at the time, but it's gaining quite a lot of attention on social media, something that Bublik shouted midway through the match about rejuvenating the career. He said, I'm fed up with... He didn't use the word rejuvenating, but the spirit of what he was saying was, I'm fed up with rejuvenating the career of, and these are his words, disabled players.
Jeez.
And he's referring to, well, we assume he's referring to losses he's now had this year to Dominic Thiem, Gael Monfils and Stan Wawrinka. All better players than Alexander Bublik, who have achieved far, far more than he has. But it's... I mean, what... He was disgraceful in every possible way today. That's long and short of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should say that I believe he said that in Russian, and it's been translated.
Right.
Can't be 100% sure of the accuracy of it, I suppose, but Thiem was asked about it, and he said, you know, if he said that, that's incredibly disrespectful. And, yeah, Bublik, who is now withdrawn from the doubles as well. He's just gone.
Has he?
Yeah, just a horrible showing for the public at this
time. Do we have any idea if he was badly injured himself or something like that?
I don't think he was injured.
No, I mean, he wears that... the sleeve thing on his calf, doesn't he? But that he wears that all the time. Look, he might have been feeling something, but that didn't look like an injury-induced performance to me. He didn't call the trainer, did he? Wasn't clutching at any body part. Unless he was suffering some sort of internal hemorrhage that we were unable to see, there's not really any excuse for...
It's not out of character, is it?
No, precisely. He's not got a lot of credit stored in the bank. But Dominic Thiem is through to the second round of a Grand Slam, and he's going to play Ben Shelton.
Okay. When's that? Because I'm going to arrange my day around it.
Yeah, well, Wednesday, and I would assume on a big court.
Yeah,
I think that's Ash.
I think it's Louis Armstrong, personally.
That's fine if it is.
I think it's Armstrong, and I almost want it to be there. I just feel like it'd be absolutely packed to the rafters.
I'd be happy with it on Grandstand, yeah. To be honest.
Would be fun
but
too.
I love Grandstand. Yeah. So
I think it's going to be interesting to watch Dominic Thiem in a setting where he presumably won't have the crowd support. You know, I think one of all the things that Thiem has lost in his career by the fact that he's had so many injuries and been out of the game for so long and is now, you know, nowhere near the player he was, one thing he has gained is a huge wave of just support for him. Like, I don't think he's always been a fairly popular player, but, you know, people feel for him and they're pushing for him and pulling for him. And, you know, we saw in Kitzbühel how great that was when he had all that support behind him. I don't know how it's going to feel for him playing against an American here in New York. I personally don't want to see people rooting against Dominic Thiem, but, you know, I'm sure he won't be taking it personally. They will be going for Shelton. But it will be a very different sort of occasion for him in that respect, I should think.
No other major shocks in the men's draw as we come to you right now. Who knows? Maybe part two will feature shocks. But Casper Ruud did have to toil today against Emilio Navas. 7-6 in the fourth he won. I think you watch some of this, I get the impression he'll need to be better in the next round when he faces Zheng Jizhen, who I really rate as a player. Zheng.
Yeah, he won in five, I think, today against JJ Wolf. I think he did well, Ruud, to get through that match in four, to be honest. That was tricky. Nava hit over 70 winners and Ruud hit fewer than 30. You know, I know you can't read everything into that, but it sort of tells you who was dictating in that match. And every time I looked up at the screen, Nava was just, he's got this really fast arm and he was bossing the rallies, and Ruud didn't look to me like he had his forehand fully firing yet. I felt like he was relying on the sort of general improvements he's made in his game to just keep himself just a little bit of a level above Nava overall. He got through a couple of tie breaks, and the fourth set one, he was down in that, came up with a brilliant lob. I think that was to set up match point. So little moments that he needed to come through. He was really tested there. It was a good match out on court 17.
I think Ruud Jung could be a really good match. Francis Tiafoe safely through. He played on Ash. He beat Lerner Tien in three straight sets. He is one kit of the tournament.
Yeah, it's a vest. Is it teal?
It is teal.
Yes.
It's the same colour Matt is wearing.
It is. It's sort of greeny blue, and it's really, really striking. And then there's a pattern down the front, and I definitely think he's won the better half of the kit release from that particular sponsor, hasn't
Agreed.
He? Because there's a sort of, I don't really know what Holger Rune was wearing, but another version of it.
I'm glad he wasn't wearing what Francis Tiafoe was wearing.
Yeah, yeah.
That feels like a Tiafoe-specific kit.
He looked very cool, anyway, and he played. Like, it's one of those things, isn't it? Coming out onto Ash, and you're playing against a compatriot who they're hopeful for things from in the future, and it's a kind of a hide into nothing, really, in terms of expectations. But Tiafoe's way of approaching it is, it's another chance to perform and to show what I've got and to lap it up, frankly, and he did.
if I die here, I die here, is what Tiafoe said in his post-match interview on court.
I've got him in the semis again.
I do too.
Have you?
I've got him beating Tommy Paul in the quarters.
That was a really tough decision.
Yeah.
But that's what I've gone for as well. What have you gone for, mate?
Same. But my predictions were hastily done in a subway carriage.
Those can be the best ones.
Yeah.
Well, what did you go
we'll
for?
We'll see.
I went Tommy Paul in that one.
Okay.
But
has everyone got that quarterfinal then? Tiafoe, Paul?
Yes.
And is that in the Runa Rude kind of section?
Yes.
That was seeded?
I felt very sure that Runa wasn't going anywhere in this tournament. Rude, I had to really deliberate over whether, like, who would win a potential Rude Tiafoe match. That feels very close to me.
Before Tiafoe on Arthur Ashe Stadium today, opening up action on Arthur Ashe Stadium, in fact, was defending champion world number one Iga Świątek, a bagel and a breadstick for her against Rebecca Peterson. I say that knowing full well Iga Świątek would hate me saying that. I wish she would find a way to sort of embrace the whole bagel breadstick thing. I totally respect that she is so wary of being disrespectful.
Yes.
But I feel like there's a way of embracing it without it being quite so awkward.
Yeah.
I feel like her anticipation of it being awkward is what's making it awkward.
She does absolutely nothing on the court to try to steer herself away from getting them. That's for sure. I mean, I was commentating on that match and she was she won the first set 6-6 in 25 minutes, went off for a break actually, came back and went immediately love 40 down. And you're thinking, okay, she's maybe lost her focus a bit. Peterson's a bit one-sided. She's got the big forehand, but really not a good backhand. And then it was like she just couldn't handle that. She couldn't handle giving a game away. And she was ravenous to get the rest of the points in the game, and she won the lot and just held on to her serve. And I thought, you know, her appetite for just winning every single point is probably unmatched, I think, in tennis just at the moment. She just will not let you have it.
19th bagel set of the year.
Wow.
She won 22 bagel sets in 2022. So will she make 23 in 2023? I rather suspect she will.
She might do it this tournament.
I think that's highly possible, yeah?
Yeah, but I do find it highly amusing that Iga Świątek starts her press conference by saying, yeah, first round's usually very, very tricky. And I'm like, are they? You've won 32 consecutive sets in first round of slams.
I wonder what the last
she said she
eight
was,
were.
She said she was particularly pleased with how she implemented the stuff that she's been working on in practice. And she really made a point about how little practice time she's had recently. I think she was, the subtext was the lengthening of the 2 week long, the 1,000 events to be 2 weeks long. I mean, she has a lot less practice time than she used to, and she doesn't like that. So she said she feels practice time is at a premium. She was really pleased with how she implemented what she's had the chance to practice on. So I asked her, what are those things, Iga? She said she didn't want to disclose trade secrets. Could you tell, David, what she might have been working on in practice? What was in evidence?
I was really impressed with her forehand today, personally. I mean, I suppose when I watch it in real life, not on the TV, I'm always taken by her incredible movement and the sort of violent action and how similar that forehand looks to Nadal's. You know, that brush up the back and the lasso around the top of the head and all the rest of it. It just felt like she was getting in the right position for everything. And even good shots coming her way were going back with interest.
I saw one nice backhand drop shot that hit in the second set, I think it was. And I suddenly had this recall of when Iga Świątek came on the scene, I definitely would have described her as a player who played with variety. That was that was definitely a feature of her play.
Contemporaries would say that, wouldn't they?
Right, way back, you know, when, you know, 2019, 2020, I think of Iga Świątek as playing with variety. But what I do remember is last year when she started working with Tomasz Witkarowski, the big sort of line that she would give in terms of what he had brought to her game was being ruthless and being really aggressive and hitting that forehand, as David described. And I don't know, I feel like if she is to maybe improve even more and get even better, I do think bringing back some of that variety might be helpful. Like, I think of some of the losses she's had, you know, against Coco Gauff recently, Jessica Pegula. It tends to be she loses points because she just keeps going for it, just keeps doing kind of the same thing. And I don't know, I feel like maybe adding some change of pace, some variety into her game would help her in those sorts of matches. I have absolutely no idea whether that's what she's working on. I'm clutching at one backhand drop shot that I saw, but
it's all I've got, Matt.
She won't tell us, so we'll fill the void and speculate. But it would, you know, maybe that's something to keep an eye on.
Well, that was happening over on Armstrong. Matt, you were watching, what's been the match of the day so far? Beatrice Haddad Meyer beating Sloane Stephens 6-2, 5-7, 6-4. I watched bits and bobs of this. Was it as good as I'm making out?
It was really good. Yeah, it looked very intense.
It was.
I think Haddad Meyer brought out my favourite Sloane Stephens, which is intense Sloane Stephens. You know, she's so smooth and almost languid at times, makes the sport look so easy. But when you combine that with an intensity, it makes for an incredible watch. And she wrestled that second set off Haddad Meyer. Then I literally sprinted out from Ash to Armstrong in an attempt to get there for the first game of the final set. You know, I didn't want to miss three games. Did get there in time because there were bathroom breaks and changes of outfits. And then there was a little lull from Sloane Stephens at the start of the third set, and Haddad Meyer broke. Then Sloane Stephens got it back, and then she had another lull. And I just think you can't afford to have those lulls against Haddad Meyer, who is intensity list all the time. And she was just kept bringing it, and Sloane Stephens was bringing it sometimes. And that to me felt like the difference, really. A very tough draw for Sloane Stephens, obviously, but tough draws didn't used to matter, or you feel like they shouldn't matter for Sloane Stephens because she can be so good. But yeah, fabulous match, great noise on Armstrong as Stephens was making her comeback. Lots of support for her Haddad Meyer as well, lots of Brazilian football shirts dotted around the stadium. And yeah, just a very common Grand Slam experience. Haddad Meyer in a third set epic in the first week. I feel like that's a feature of all of our Grand Slams at the moment.
She's a banker for drama and intensity and entertainment at the moment, isn't she? She's a good ticket, Beatrice Haddad Meyer. We had Maria Sakkari going out of a Grand Slam in the first round for the third consecutive slam today. This loss to Rebecca Masarova in two straight sets, not actually a hugely close match. We were doing all the jokes about how Sakkari was a set and a breakdown, she's got her right where she wants her, and the defiance never came. She's only won two Grand Slam matches this season. I didn't see a lot of the match itself. I was following it on live scores while out on grandstand watching Dominic Thiem, but I did go to Maria Sakkari's press conference, and it was a tough scene. I know Maria Sakkari is someone that feels her feelings and wears her heart on her sleeve, but I've never seen her quite like that before. She was not only very upset, but she was despairing, really. She was at a loss as to what was going on. She said, you know, I obviously need to do something different, and I sort of pressed her on that a little bit. I said, do you have any idea what that might be? Because it's not effort, right? You can't try any harder. And she sort of gave that a knowing nod, like, yeah, that's exactly it. I can't. It's not lack of effort here. I'm doing everything I possibly can, and I feel like I'm going backwards, and that must just feel horrendous. And
feel quite sorry
her
for
last
it,
words
yeah.
of the press conference were, she's going to consider taking a break. She said, I might take a break, I don't know. She said she didn't feel like her mind was clear enough right now to make that decision. But I think that might be the decision she ends up making, and I kind of hope it is. That isn't a player that's kind of fit for the tour right now.
Tough section of the tour if you've had a really dispiriting few Grand Slams and you're at her ranking. You've got to rebuild, and I don't know, that I think that's a slog the next few months, and I don't know.
And her ranking will soon plummet. She'll stop being seeded.
She could do it being an underdog, though.
I was thinking the lower ranking. The same, David. Name drop, but we do drop this name all the time. We were talking to Pam Shriver, and she said something really interesting, which was the fact that chasing the top is exhausting. Pam said, I was in that position for years. You know, not quite at the top, but it was within sight, and I was trying to get there, and, you know, couldn't quite make it. And Zachary has been in that position for a long time now, and her ranking this year hasn't reflected her performances. You know, she, you know, four straight losses in slams, three straight first round exits. She's not playing like a player who is ranked where she is. And actually, I agree. I think if she has to take a break, and that may well be the best thing, coming back as a bit more of an underdog, maybe with a bit less expectation, in the sort of macro sense of what we say she's like in matches where she plays better when she's behind and an underdog, that might help her. It won't be easy to climb the rankings again, there's so many good players, but it might be a easier mental space to be in, I suppose. I hope so, because it was really, really distressing and harrowing seeing that. I really, really felt for her.
I think that's a really good point. A few other women's results from this first half of the day. Rybakina Cruz, a lot of people thought that would be tough for her against Marta Kostyuk, but Kostyuk was all over the place today. She didn't seem happy at all. She was dressed as a tennis ball. Maybe that was part of the problem. I typically love Marta Kostyuk's kits, and I know she plays a big part in designing them, doesn't she? But this one was quite fluoro. but we won't be seeing it again because Rybakina wasn't tested today. Difficult to draw any conclusions, really, about where she and her shoulder are at. Karolina Mukova, Victoria Azarenka, Belinda Bencic, Danielle Collins, all safely through with no dramas at all, really. Just wanted to flag that Collins looked particularly good against Linda Fravitova on grandstand court, and she's a potential opponent for Coco Gauff in the third round. I won't say too much more on that because obviously Coco Gauff hasn't played yet. We'll be covering her match in the second half of the show, so just in case Gauff loses, let's not discuss that in detail. But as much as I have predicted Coco Gauff to win this tournament, I do think that's a danger. Fired up Danielle Collins
when
playing
Collins
like this
is
in round
well.
Three.
Yeah, when she's on, she's a threat to most players.
Yeah. So, Coco Gauff coming up in part two, as is Novak Djokovic. They headline the night session on Arthur Ashe Stadium tonight. They play after a opening ceremony which will celebrate the 50th anniversary of equal prize money. Billie Jean King is involved. We'll be watching. We can't wait. Over on Armstrong, Milos Raonic takes on Stefanos Tsitsipas. Caroline Wozniacki in action. We will be back with part two to wrap up all of that and anything else that goes on court number 5, which is, of course, where it's at on day one at the US Open. Back in a mo.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. We're back, folks. And by we, I mean myself and Matt Roberts, because David Law is still at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Centre, and he is commentating on Novak Djokovic, who, despite the fact that it's 14 minutes past midnight, is still on court. He's doing his best to catch up the clock, though. 6-love, 6-2, 1-all against poor Alexandre Muller of France, the prey for this evening. I mean... extremely difficult, Matt, to draw any conclusions about how Novak Djokovic is playing on the basis of this, other than he looks darn good.
Yeah, I feel like we've seen Novak Djokovic in this situation quite a lot recently. Like, he's not against the clock tonight in the way that he was at Wimbledon a few times, but I think he's against the sort of own clock that he himself has probably set. You know, he doesn't want to be here in the middle of the night playing Alexandre Muller if he can avoid it. And I don't know, it feels like seeing Djokovic in a slightly new light. I don't associate urgency with Novak Djokovic generally. His matches tend to be quite drawn out and, you know, slow often. But,
well, hang on, we might have redefined slow tonight.
Look, it was a deliberate word choice.
Right, okay, let's get to the heart of the matter, shall we? Because the reason that Novak Djokovic is still on court at 12:15 is, well, I mean, the primary reason is tennis. It's not unusual for tennis still to be on at 12:15. Of course it's not. But the specific reason for it tonight is because the first match of the evening on the Arthur Ashe Stadium was Coco Gauff beating Laura Siegemund of Germany 3-6, 6-2, 6-4 in 2 hours and 51 minutes. A circus of a tennis match. I know opinions on this match will vary quite widely. I have lots,
but not
of,
on this podcast.
Not on this podcast. And I think we can confidently say that if David were here, he'd be agreeing with us.
Oh, I watched this match feet away from David, right, and he was living for it.
We loved it.
Yeah.
We absolutely loved it. I know you were watching with Mary Carrillo's commentary. She was alongside Lindsay Davenport. I was watching the ESPN coverage, so I had Chris Evert and I had Pam Shriver courtside. That was fantastic. I know Mary didn't love it so much. I think she found it just tough. Tough was the word I think she used. And maybe if we had been commentating, we'd have found it tough as well. And look, I'm not saying that Laura Siegemund's behaviour wasn't absolutely egregious in many different respects tonight. I'm just saying, for me, it was all, as a neutral observer, not having to be down the other end of the court from her, it was right in the sweet spot
of circus and aggro for me.
Yeah, me too. We watched that match basically as tennis fans, and I was hugely entertained by it. I think what Mary was a bit frustrated by was the fact that it became about something other than the tennis. And I think that was frustrating for Mary because for the first set and a bit, it was all about the tennis, and it was really, really interesting. You know, Sigmund was being slow and, you know, taking all her time and running the serve clock down to zero, even in that first set. But it wasn't the story of that first set. The story was the incredibly good and incredibly smart tennis that Sigmund was playing, coming to the net so much, playing the match on her terms against Coco Gauff, who I didn't think played a terrible set, played a terrible final game of the set. And, you know, the forehand was making some errors, and there was a slightly uneasy feeling about sort of, oh no, we've all talked Coco Gauff up. She's come in such good form. Is she going to lose in the first round? Sigmund was playing that well that it genuinely was a possibility at that stage. But Lindsay Davenport said something in commentary, which was, well, if Sigmund played all her matches like this, she wouldn't be having to qualify, which was a tremendous line. And also, I think, you know, a really good read on the match that it probably wasn't likely that Sigmund's form was going to last for another set playing like that. It always felt like Gauff would get a moment, a chance, and it all turned, I think, tennis wise and the feel, the atmosphere, the mood of the match in that just extraordinary game to start the second set, where Coco Gauff had so many break points before finally breaking. I think it was about a 25-minute game in the end, maybe longer. And it just all flipped there. Gauff managed to sort of take Sigmund's legs away for a while. And then I think Sigmund knew that she had to revert even more to the dastardly dark arts. And she did. She lent into those from that moment on.
So dark.
So dark.
Dark as the New York night. I was seriously, my moment of serious concern for Coco Gauff, because as you say, I don't think the story of that first set was her playing that badly. But the way she conceded her serve to lose that opening set was limp. And quite shocking to me, actually. Dumped a forehand in the net, just surrendered that first set extremely meekly. And there was this eerie silence around the crowd. And I thought, hang on, like, okay, your opponent's inspired, she's annoying, you're not having your best day, but where's the fight? And of course, that ended up being completely forthcoming. It was just a moment of out of character flatness, I suppose. But I was, for that moment, really seized by panic on Coco Gauff's behalf. But she managed to find it in the end, and I'm sure the dark arts helped her find it. I mean, to be clear on just how dark those arts were, I mean, we're watching Novak Djokovic right now, and he and Rafael Nadal have kind of redefined time taken between points. I think our tolerance as a tennis watching public of time taken between points without us really noticing it has increased massively over the course of the last 15 years. And yet I've never seen anybody push it the way Laura Siegman was, because she wasn't just absolutely maxing out on the time in between points, running down that clock, literally waiting till it hit zero to start her motion. But then she developed this extraordinary service motion.
Glacial.
Which involved holding her sort of ready position of racket and ball out in front of her. I mean, there were times when I thought the TV had frozen, honestly. And the umpire who, look, I don't think she had a perfect night tonight, but I do think she was dealing with something pretty unprecedented, which was that Laura Siegman changed her service motion. She doesn't do that usually. She's not a quick player, but she doesn't do that. That was a tactic against Coco Gauff, who likes to play quickly. Laura Siegman is a total disruptor. Her A game is get under the opponent's skin, irritate them, and P.S. she is expert at it. but it was a very strange one for Marijana Valjevic to have to deal with, because she was operating the service clock and Laura Siegman was starting her motion just about on zero every time, which is hard to punish. You know, Novak Djokovic's ball bouncing isn't included in the time between points. It's counted as part of the motion. And yet that in itself can go on for so long. But to say that she was taking the piss with it would be just... I mean, I was bursting out laughing watching it. And what you have in the ESPN coverage is you had Patrick McEnroe and Chrissy Evert in the booth, but you had Pam courtside and her mic is always live, so she can interject whenever she feels appropriate, and she's fantastic at it. You know, just the right amount of input, but the best input of the lot was during the most extended service motions. You just hear, and it was Pam. It was fantastic.
And eventually, that was Coco Gauff as well. Like, I think she really kept it together for a good portion of that match, and then just snapped. She had enough of Laura Siegman.
And what caused her to snap was Laura Siegman doing it on Coco Goff's serve. She was trying to hold up Gauff
by going
serving
over to the towel and just taking all the time she could possibly take.
You know, the
rule
is you play at the service pace, and I thought Coco Gauff, given the level of fury she must have been experiencing, I thought she expressed herself brilliantly. She was like, look, she can do whatever she likes on her own serve, I get that, but you play at the service pace.
She said, on my serve, she has to be ready. And it was like, period. And, note to self, don't get in an argument with Coco Gauff, because she will... she will put you away.
Well, except she said after the match in the press conference, she said, you know, I'm not a confrontational person. And I really didn't want to have to do that. But she just reached that point of no return. And it was at that point she had been in total control of the match. It was at that point that there was just a little wobble
It was
in their deciding set. So, I don't know. I don't want to read too much into the fact that that happened, because my read on it is those were extremely exceptional circumstances. I don't see Coco Gauff being... I don't see Coco Gauff's inability to control her temper or keep a lid on her emotions being a potential thing that could hold her back in the future.
No, she's not playing Laura Siegman every match. This was very, very
Although,
specific.
Very keen for them to play again.
Oh, yeah.
At the soonest possible opportunity. What's your take on this match and what it means for Coco Gauff this tournament? My feeling is, and obviously I speak as somebody that has predicted she'll win the tournament, so everything is coloured by that lens, but Coco Gauff's new thing that's clicked with Brad Gilbert and over the course of this summer is kind of the same thing that clicked for Iga Swiatek at the start of last season, which is, I don't have to play my best. Being a perfectionist is actually holding me back. My B game can be good enough. Let's look at the floor rather than the ceiling. That's what makes champions. And I thought tonight was further proof of concept for that, for Coco Gauff. Further proof of how she can problem solve. Okay, there was a lot of input from the sidelines tonight tactically. And I actually thought tonight was a really good advert for courtside coaching. In that, for me, obviously, language-wise, it helped that we could understand everything that Brad Gilbert was saying, but you could hear really clearly what he was telling her to do and see her putting it into action. And it really enhanced my viewing experience. Come to the net. Take the net away from her.
Yeah.
Lob. For goodness sake, Coco, hit some lobs. Lo and behold, she becomes a lobbing machine, and it was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And those were the two big differences, the way she managed to take the net away from Siegmund a bit in that second set, and then when Siegmund was at the net, coming up with the lobs. And I'm always so impressed when a player manages to problem solve. That's largely what I'm looking for, I suppose, in a tennis player when I'm watching them. Can you adjust? Can you adapt? You know, Billie Jean King, champions adjust. So I think from that point of view, very, very impressive. I think you can read more into that than, you know, if she just won really straightforwardly tonight. And she said that on court, didn't she? She said she wasn't pleased with how she played, but she was pleased that she made it through. And I think, you know, there was a real chance that she didn't come through that match tonight, because, cannot stress enough, Siegmund was playing so well and then just such a pest. So very impressive, I think from Coco Gauff. And she meets Mira Andreeva in a match that we thought would happen in the second round, and it will. Andreeva also a winner in three sets tonight.
Mm. Sign me up for that one. I rather suspect that'll be first night session match.
Think so.
On Arthur Ashe Stadium in 2 days' time. Following Coco Gauff and Nora Siegmund onto court was the much-anticipated opening ceremony, which this year honoured the 50th anniversary of equal prize money being awarded at a tournament for the first time at the US Open here in 1973. Although, as Chris Evert was very right to point out in commentary, it wasn't the US Open that stumped up that prize money. It was Billie Jean King going out and finding a commercial sponsor. Mm. It was Bristol Myers, wasn't it, that stumped up that prize money, and the US Open said, okay, well, if you got the money, then sure, we'll agree to it. But look, it's more than anybody else was doing at the time, so don't want to take too much away. I just think it's an important note about the history of it all. Matt, you were in the stadium for the ceremony for Billie Jean King, for Michelle Obama, for Sarah Bareilles. That's one of those names that I've only ever read. I've never heard it said out loud
before.
They
said Sarah Bareilles.
Did they?
Hmm.
That's what I thought it was, but I thought they were saying Sarah Bareilles. Oh, man. I can't wait for up mentions in the morning. But of course, you're right. What was it all like? I mean, I watched it on the TV, but...
Do you know, it was just, I think, the most tennis evening possible, because so much of it was good and great. And, you know, we had this amazing women's match. Coco Gauff and Laura Siegmund had entertained everyone for 3 hours. It was fantastic. And it was on the biggest stage in the sport. You know, there's a long way to go for women, even in tennis, to get the treatment that they deserve. But they do get better stage and better treatment in tennis than in a lot of other sports. And that was showcased tonight. And then we had this incredibly important, powerful ceremony with Billie Jean King and Michelle Obama both giving incredible speeches and saying such
they
important
really were.
Things. They were both just note perfect, as they would be. And yet then, because it was tennis, it was all happening at 10:30 at night. And it felt like it was having to be a bit squeezed in and a bit rushed. I mean, you've never seen a red carpet laid so quickly and a piano assembled so quickly and so many people on hand needed to do all of those things. It was nice, actually, the singing and Sarah Bareilles. It was, you know, it was a great performance, and it was all nice, but there was just this feeling of, well, there's another match to go. And in particular, and this weird feeling that it's a men's match now. You know, we're celebrating women and we're celebrating equal prize money, and now we've got a best of five set men's match. It just slightly felt a little bit off, you know, when it should have been so right. It should have, like, to me, they could have even extended that ceremony and had that and a match as today's session, night session, or two women's matches.
And look, I didn't think of it ahead of time when the schedule came out for today.
Yeah, me neither.
I didn't, but then, you know, I wasn't on the organising committee. I'd like, you know, but
yeah,
I don't want to come down too hard on them. But equally, as soon as the whole thing started, it suddenly clanged. I was like, no, this isn't right. That I know Novak Djokovic and Alexandra Muller are waiting in the wings to follow Michelle Obama and Billie Jean King onto the court. It's not terrible. It just feels like a real missed opportunity.
Yeah,
I think. But it was good, the ceremony.
It really
apart
was.
From a slightly odd moment with glasses, it was.
Yes.
It was really good, I think.
Oh yeah, it really was.
There's no need to speak of the glasses
ever again.
Moment ever again. Novak Djokovic does look well on the way to victory. Of course, we'll be back with an addendum if the world's most extraordinary comeback happens from Alexandra Muller. But pretty confident that you won't be hearing from us again tonight. No other major upsets. Félix Auger-Aliassime lost to Mackenzie McDonald in four sets. We all thought that would happen. It's a tough scene for Felix just now.
Yeah, and I was trying to keep as close an eye on this match as I could to just try and really judge how Auger-Aliassime was playing. Because I don't feel like I've watched him that much, because he's been not playing that much, because he's been losing so early in tournaments. And overall, I didn't think he was playing too badly, and it was a pretty high quality match, I felt, against Mackenzie McDonald. But it was just a classic case of a player short on confidence. You know, whenever he got into a kind of big moment, that was when the errors came, and he had 13 break points in the match, only managed to convert one of them. And in the final game, he had three break back points to extend the fourth set, and just made errors on all of the break points, having set them up really well, you know. And in the end of the first set, he double faulted on set point. You know, it was things like that. The difference was McDonald was better when it mattered. And that so often is the story of tennis, I suppose. And Auger-Aliassime just looks completely shot of confidence. You know, compare him to the guy we saw at the end of last season, who was winning titles and
three titles in a row,
and then helping Canada win
less than a year ago
the Davis Cup. He was stepping up in all the big, and he felt so secure, you trusted him. It's the complete opposite now.
Really, really tough to see. It'd be interesting to watch that space and see if the coaching relationship with Tony Nadal persists. I'm not saying Tony's to blame, but he clearly needs a jolt. That's the word of the moment, isn't it? Maybe a break and a jolt. Who knows? Caroline Wozniacki won on her return to the US Open on Armstrong. And Stefanos Tsitsipas won on Armstrong as well. Took care of Milos Raonic very handily.
Honestly, second straight year where Stefanos Tsitsipas has played a night session match on the opening day of the US Open. And it has totally passed me by.
I saw the post-match interview where he just looks like he's in a daze at the moment, doesn't he? I mean, he always has done at the best of times, but anyway, I haven't got any Tsitsipas gags. It's too late for that. I'll spare you.
I was a little bit worried about this match for him, given the record against Raonic. I think it's a pretty emphatic scoreline. I think he was a breakdown in the third set, but managed to recover it pretty straightforwardly. Just the sort of win that he needed, I suppose.
Yep, absolutely. He trucks on to round number two. We have the remainder of the round one matches to come tomorrow. Daniil Medvedev opens up Ash, then it's Jessica Pegula, Venus Williams first in the night session, and then Carlos Alcaraz. Armstrong is Jabeur, then Madison Keys. John Isner playing what could be his last ever singles match, last on the day session on Armstrong tomorrow, and then Jannik Sinner and Aryna Sabalenka are in the night session. The best matches of the day tomorrow are out and about around the grounds. Grandstand opens with Alexandrova against Fernandez, which I think could be fun. And then it's Andy Murray against Corentin Moutet. Wawrinka against Nishioka, also on Grandstand tomorrow. That's good fun. Look, there's good stuff. It's good. Good day to have a grounds pass tomorrow. Court five is Caroline Garcia against Wang Yifan, and we think that could be an upset, if it even is an upset just now. Who knows? But Rublev, Rusevori over there as well. Good stuff. Griekspor against Fis. We know where David will be at 11 a.m. tomorrow. Court number 10 for that. So lots to look forward to on day two. We'll be there. David will be there. We will all be back tomorrow for our day two podcast, brought to you in association with AO Travel throughout the fortnight. We have our mascot for the fortnight, and that is lovely Willow. Hello, Willow. We have our mascots. I've got Xenia. David's got Maisie, and Matt has Darwin.
Sorry, Darwin, bad start.
David usually says hello, Maisie, at this point.
He does.
He does, yeah. And he'll be doing that tomorrow when he'll be back. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. It's never felt cooler to say that than tonight. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And we don't have shout-outs, because what is a shout-out without David Law? We wouldn't want to disappoint any of you who have paid your hard-earned money for a tennis podcast shout-out, and you want your name to be likened to someone obscure from the 90s.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, shout-outs will be back tomorrow, as will David, as will we, as will the tennis. It'll probably be going on till 2 a.m, but that's... Yeah. It's what we came for, folks.
Yeah, I mean, we're already in tomorrow, aren't we?
It is already tomorrow. You know it's a grand slam when we're saying things like that. Thanks for listening. We'll speak to you later today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.